Thank you, Jeff. Frankly, any performance review I'd ever do with Jeff goes something like this. Jeff, what do I need to do to make sure you never, ever leave this association? Because he's phenomenal. He does a great job for the association, but for the ethanol industry, and greatly appreciate the kind remarks. I wasn't kidding, though, or he wasn't kidding. I really did tell him that the performance review was going to be done immediately after this, so you don't have to believe any of the nice things he just said about me. Before I get started, I do want to thank the Grange Council and Tom Doerr in particular for organizing this event and allowing the Renewable Fuels Association to take some small part in it. I really do believe this is a critically important issue, and we need to have Tom's continued leadership, the Grange Council's continued leadership on this issue, because it's just too important for the bottom line of our industry. As Jeff sort of indicated, today is indeed an unprecedented time for the ethanol industry. We are indeed at somewhat of a crossroads. Efforts to expand ethanol's place in the market are being challenged and potentially artificially limited. Critical policies that have built America into the largest ethanol producer in the world will expire at the end of this year unless this dysfunctional Congress can get its act together. At the same time, critical breakthroughs in ethanol production technologies are on the cusp of commercialization, waiting for signals that a market will exist for their product. Now, all of these have a direct impact on the reason why you're all here today. As a nation, failure to continue the growth of our domestic ethanol industry will not only limit our ability to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, but it will constrain our ability to provide a high-quality livestock feed to producers across the country and the world. Make no mistake about it. The success of the distillers' grains market is indeed directly related to the fate of the American ethanol industry. Now let's take a step back and look at how we got here. American ethanol production has been on a tremendous growth curve over the past several years. Last year alone, we produced some 10.7 billion gallons of ethanol and 30 million metric tons of distiller's feed. Now, I started with this industry in 1988 when we were producing just a bit more than 600 million gallons. So now, some 23 years, three children, or 80 pounds ago, we find ourselves at a place that none of us could have imagined. Now, it's important as well that as the ethanol industry has grown, we've grown beyond the traditional Midwest. You see ethanol production facilities today in California, in Texas, in Florida, in Georgia, in New York. And as ethanol production expands, political support for the industry grows because they now recognize what ethanol really means to rural economies. And we're growing beyond or away from traditional feed markets, issues that I think are important for this audience. Ethanol today is used effectively in vehicles coast to coast, representing nearly 10% of the U.S. gasoline supply. Ethanol production provides much-needed economic stimulus to hundreds of rural communities, helping to support nearly 400,000 jobs and adding $550 billion to the U.S. economy. In addition, ethanol production today is the second largest market for corn in the United States, only surpassed by feed uses. Without the new demand brought on by ethanol production, American farmers would not be producing 13 billion bushels of corn this year, and seed companies would not be investing in the technologies to double this production on the same acres within a generation. The single most important market for farmers today has been ethanol production. It is stimulating rural economies, but it is absolutely allowing companies to make the investments necessary so that we continue to fuel, feed, and clothe the world. But what often gets neglected is the fact that one-third of every bushel of corn entering an ethanol biorefinery is returned to feed markets, largely in the form of distiller's feed. and the production of distillers' grains directly mirrors that of fuel ethanol production. Just in this decade, we have seen distillers' grains production grow from just a few million metric tons to more than 33 million metric tons expected this crop year. And total feed production, including corn gluten and gluten and corn gluten meal, grow to more than 36 million metric tons. In fact, the amount of distillers' grains produced last year is equal to the total amount of grain fed to cattle in American feedlots. Let me repeat that. The amount of distillers' grain produced last year is equal to the total amount of grain fed to the cattle in American feedlots. That's why what happens in Washington has a direct bearing on distillers' grains markets. Now, the resolution of five key policy decisions are going to determine the future of the American ethanol industry and the future of what happens with distillers' feed. What happens with the tax incentive, the volumetric ethanol excise tax credit? What happens with the tariff? What happens with the blend wall? What happens with the implementation of the renewable fuel standard? And certainly what happens at the state level and at the federal level on future carbon policy? All of these are going to have a huge impact. But before I discuss them individually, I think it's important to talk about just a little background, give you a little flavor for what's happening in Washington today. Washington, D.C. is a broken town. It's dysfunctional, likely unable even to pass a resolution in support of Mother's Day. I kid you not. Concerns over budgets and deficits dominate conversations as Republicans salivate and Democrats cringe over the upcoming elections. With Congress now recessed until November, nothing's going to happen on issues important to this industry until there's clarity with the elections. The only chance we're going to have to accomplish anything as yet this year will be in a lame duck session of Congress. And too often, as the name suggests, very little gets done in a lame duck session. But I've been in this industry for 23 years, and as Jeff indicated, I'm a Red Sox fan. So I am the epitome of the eternal optimist. And I do have this happy place that when the Congress returns, they will in fact be motivated to do something on tax policy. They're going to have to do something to make sure that the government continues to operate. The continuing resolution that they passed last month only took them to December 3rd. So they're going to have to get something to the president's desk, perhaps relieved of the polarization that occurs in an intense election season. There will, in fact, be motivation to address pressing national issues like tax policy, and hopefully we can move forward and get the tax incentive extended. On December 31 of this year, the tax incentive, the volumetric ethanol excise tax credit, is set to expire unless Congress acts to extend it. Now, this has been the top legislative priority of the Renewable Fuels Association because it has the most direct bearing on whether or not American ethanol production continues to move forward. The math and rationale behind VTEC is simple. Blenders of ethanol take a 45-cent per gallon tax credit for every gallon of ethanol they use, regardless of where it comes from. It encourages often reluctant petroleum interests to blend more ethanol beyond what is mandated and install the necessary infrastructure to do so. Remember, we are selling to our competitors. Our customer are the big oil companies that would just as soon throughput more hydrocarbons and fewer carbohydrates. They've grown comfortable over the years using ethanol as an octane enhancer, as a blend component. They are still not entirely comfortable with ethanol replacing more and more of the gallon, which is indeed going to be the case if ethanol continues to grow. Ethanol lowers the price for consumers. It's proven to be the largest driver in the expansion of ethanol production in the U.S., and the tax incentive has been extraordinarily important to improving our energy and economic security in this country. Now, it's tied directly, the tax incentive is tied directly to a secondary tariff on ethanol that's imposed to prevent foreign companies from gaining access to U.S. taxpayer dollars. It's not there to protect the industry. Plenty of ethanol is imported today, and it competes quite well. It's just the U.S. Congress wants to stimulate production here. And much ethanol produced across the globe is subsidized in those countries, and through decades of tax incentives and production mandates and debt forgiveness and loan guarantees and infrastructure development and export enhancements, countries like, say, Brazil, pulling one out of the air, have built a heck of an industry. They don't need the U.S. taxpayer dollars as well. So the secondary tariff is in place to assure that that doesn't occur. As long as the tax incentive is in place and is available to all ethanol, whether it's imported or domestic, I believe the secondary tariff will continue to be there. It's never been a barrier to entry, and hundreds of millions of gallons are indeed imported into the U.S. every year. But failure to extend the tax incentive or the tariff in addition to the volumetric ethanol tax incentive could lead to a surge in ethanol imports that would have a devastating impact on the domestic industry. Now, more importantly, failure to extend these policies would cost Americans jobs, plain and simple. There's simply no way around it. While estimates may differ, allowing the tax incentive to expire would force perhaps as much as 37% of U.S. ethanol production to idle and cost more than 100,000 jobs. Now, we can discuss what we want to do with the tax incentive moving forward. I hope that we have that conversation in the United States Congress with all energy tax incentives on the table. I don't believe it's necessary or at all useful to be having a unilateral discussion about what to do with the ethanol tax incentives when, quite frankly, the petroleum industry continues to receive significant benefits throughout the tax code and other subsidies. You know, I find it somewhat interesting that the tax incentives that the petroleum industry in this country continues to get are embedded into the tax code. They're permanent. They don't have to go to the United States Congress every few years for review, asking them to be reauthorized and trying to find offsets for their use. What we need to do is stimulate a discussion so that we're having a more robust discussion about energy tax policy and make sure that all energy tax incentives, be them petroleum or coal or nuclear or solar or other renewable fuels, it all needs to be on the table, and we need to make a decision about what our energy future really needs to look like. In that context, I am quite confident that the United States Congress will reflect the will of the people and will conclude that we need to continue the evolution of the ethanol industry. If you're going to have other advanced biofuels, if cellulose ethanol is ever going to take off, if you're going to create markets for biobutanol or algae or name your forward-looking advanced biofuel, you better make sure that the foundation that has built the biofuels industry, the grain ethanol industry, continues to have strong support and commitment from the federal government. The government walks away from that commitment now, investors are going to be chilled about what to do for the future. We believe that this discussion is going to continue. We hope, desperately, that it is continuing with the tax incentive continued to be in place. Last year, the close of the of 2009, the Congress failed to extend the biodiesel tax credit. And you can look and see what happened to that industry. U.S. biodiesel production has plummeted. That industry has suffered enormously. Tens of thousands of jobs have been lost as a consequence. We can't let that happen. Let's have a discussion about the future. Great. But in the meanwhile, let's make sure that the foundation and the structural underpinnings of this industry remain in place. You know, such a dramatic reduction in U.S. ethanol production that would occur if you were to lose the ethanol tax incentive, we believe would have profound impacts on the distillers' grains market as well. As much as 13 million metric tons of distillers feed could be lost if 37% of the industry is shut down even temporarily as a result of the failure of the Congress to extend the tax incentive. As domestic livestock producers and international trading partners have become accustomed to using this high-quality product, it remains unclear just how a dramatic disruption, the loss of up to one-third of the distillers market, would mean. It also remains unclear just how far farm prices and family farm income would plummet. These are all things that Congress needs to be thinking about. Frankly, they're all things that those of you in the U.S. need to be reminding their members of Congress that they need to be thinking about before Congress adjourns. Now, expanding the market for ethanol through the use of higher ethanol blends is also extremely critical to America's ethanol future. If extending the tax incentive is a priority, and priority number one, expanding the market for ethanol is priority 1A. Right now, the U.S. EPA is contemplating whether or not to allow the use of 15% ethanol, or E15 as it's known, in a gallon of gasoline. Currently, EPA has arbitrarily limited ethanol content to just 10% of the gallon. At a 10% rate, ethanol's share of the market could only be approximately 13.5 billion gallons out of the 135 billion gallon gasoline market in this country. Now, ethanol production this year is expected to reach 12.8 billion or maybe close to 13 billion gallons, running dangerously close to that 10% volume cap. That's why we talk about hitting that blend wall. In the coming days, EPA is expected to announce a decision on whether to allow E15 for vehicles made in 2007 or newer. Now, some in the industry may tell you that that's fine, it's a good first step. But we have some serious concerns about what EPA is doing. First, EPA has provided no scientific justification for such a decision. Test after test after test have shown E15 to be safe and effective for the entire light-duty fleet. Limiting it to just 2007 seems to us to be pulling something out of thin air. Moreover, creating a bifurcated car market in this matter simply adds confusion at the point of sale, and it's going to chill gasoline marketers from potentially making the decision to offer E15 in the first place. To be blunt, our concern with an EPA decision in this manner will result in very few additional ethanol gallons being sold in the near term, and raising expectations without providing marketplace opportunities and simply adding more confusion to consumers and gasoline marketers as well. Equally troubling is the signal EPA is sending that it will approve E15 for 2001 and newer vehicles, maybe sometime this winter, January or December. Now, while encompassing perhaps a bit more of the vehicle fleet, perhaps as much as 60% of the total light-duty fleet in this country, it's still going to leave tens of millions of vehicles out and still create the same kind of confusion and concern generated by a 2007 and newer decision. EPA needs to make these fuels available for all vehicles, period. You know, it's not like this is something new. Brazil has used as much as E25 in its vehicles for a quarter of a century. Now, okay, these are vehicles that are produced by real exotic car companies, Ford, General Motors, and Honda, and Toyota. This is not a technical issue. There really isn't a single technical reason why E15 can't be made available to all vehicles. But don't take my word for it. Ricardo Incorporated, a worldwide and highly respected automotive engineering firm, tried to determine what was magic about 2001. Was there anything different about the materials used in those vehicles? Was there anything different with the emissions regulations at that time? was there a drivability issue with older vehicles? And they did an exhaustive study and they concluded, no. The same plastics, the same elastomers, the same metals, the same fuel systems, the same regulations, the same drivability impacts, whether it's a 1999, a 1995, a 1994 vehicle, as a 2001 vehicle. There is no reason to arbitrarily limit the availability of E15 to just 2007 or 2001 and newer vehicles. But it's an indication of just how far out of touch EPA is. While theoretical volumes demonstrate that the decisions EPA is making could result in some significant volumes of additional ethanol sales, discussions that the RFA has had with fuel retailers across the country suggest that the marketplace impact is going to be significantly less. The president of the Petroleum Marketers Association recently stated, quote, limiting the waiver to a specific class of vehicles based on date of manufacture means retailers would be forced by market conditions to carry both E10 and E15 products, thus increasing the risk of consumer misfueling. Now, the good news is that the waiver will not likely require E15, but only allow its use. Refiners are not expected to supply E15 as a result of the waiver approval alone, unquote. That's what the petroleum marketers themselves are saying. Now, nevertheless, the RFA, we do firmly believe that E15 and E20 and higher level blends are indeed going to be used in this country in the very short future. They must. The only viable alternative to foreign oil in this country today is ethanol. Increasing ethanol sales means more distillers' grains. By moving to E15 for all vehicles, as the RFA has called for and repeatedly demonstrated it is scientifically justified, distillers' grains production would grow from roughly 33 million metric tons this year to more than potentially 50 million metric tons. That's why this conference is so important, because if we're going to be producing 50 million metric tons, it's going to need a marketplace. Now, other factors driving U.S. ethanol demand and thus the production of distillers' grains include the Renewable Fuel Standard. The RFS requires that the United States use 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels by 2022. Of this volume, only 15 billion gallons under the current law can be derived from grain, the rest from cellulose and other advanced biofuels. But this chart shows you just how much the biofuels industry in this country is going to continue to grow. And some of those other advanced biofuels may also have feed byproducts that will be entering the marketplace. As we just discussed, the current cap on ethanol blending due to the arbitrary 10% limit is no more than 13.5 billion gallons. Without question, we're going to have to see ethanol use grow. Blends such as E12 or E15 are needed right now today, and higher blends such as E20 or E50 or E85 must become a part of the fueling mix. If that doesn't happen, that chart I just showed you about the increasing levels of biofuels that are required to be used in this country cannot be met. It will not be possible. The other area that, from a policy perspective, is going to be impacting this sector in a serious way are carbon regulations, both at the federal level and in the state level. They're going to be key to watch. States like California are moving aggressively forward with what I would characterize as a somewhat punitive program that would systematically eliminate starch-based ethanol based upon so-called science that has been routinely and roundly refuted. These initiatives, or worse, a patchwork of similar initiatives across the country as other states and other regions try to copy what California is doing, will have the potential to profoundly limit the use of ethanol and renewable fuels. Low-carbon fuel policies encourage or require, in some cases, ethanol producers to lower their energy use, which could have unexpected indirect impacts on co-product markets. For instance, a plant that does not dry its distiller's grain today gets a much more favorable score under the California program than does an identical plant that is drying its distiller's feed. Corn oil and removal is similarly encouraged by some of these policies. Will this result in increased production of wet distiller's feed, more fractionization and corn oil separation? We do not know. But without a doubt, ethanol companies are doing everything that they can today to keep marketplace opportunities available to them. That means California, which is the single largest gasoline market in the United States. They sell 14 billion gallons of gasoline every year. That's 1.4 billion gallons of ethanol. If grain ethanol is denied that market, that's going to be a problem. So companies are looking at these technologies, and it could absolutely have an impact on distillers' feed. Now, I've been talking a great deal about policies that impact ethanol and its use. These policies and regulations are absolutely very important, not only to the use of renewable fuel, but to the market for distillers' grains as well. You've heard talk about the ethanol blend wall, the amount of ethanol that can be used. But in much the same manner, we're rapidly approaching a feed wall. Due to current limits in dietary rations, the livestock feed markets will likely be saturated with distiller's grains when the industry is producing between 35 and 45 million metric tons of feed. As we spoke about before, we're rapidly approaching the low end of those estimates. As distiller's grains grow in importance to the financial health of ethanol producers and the quality of the product continues to improve, finding new markets is vital. And that's where you come in. America's ethanol and grain producers are committed to establishing and maintaining good relationships with trading partners all around the globe. We recognize that we need to work with you to expand markets for our product. At the same time, we're aware of the value of distillers' grains to the world feed market and want to be seen as consistent and reliable trading partners. Now, as goes ethanol policy, so goes the market for distillers' grains. Extending current investments in ethanol, expanding ethanol market share, and ensuring the renewable fuel standard is successful will all be essential to the continued growth of affordable supplies of distillers' grains. Ethanol production is fuel and feed, and the success of one has a great impact on the viability of the other. Together is the only way we can secure market growth for both. I'm glad you're here with us. These are important issues and important discussions. I look forward to a spirited and thoughtful discussion that expands the market for distillers' grains, both domestically and internationally. Thank you very much.
Take a question now.